Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with us, whether you're listening on the radio, online, or on demand. I am grateful you are here. Today is primary day in New York City, and the polls are open until 9 p.m., so get out there and vote. Coming up later in today's show, we'll discuss the recent job numbers that revealed American workers are quitting at the highest rates in the past two decades. Forbes senior contributor Jack Kelly reported on this, and he'll join us later to discuss. And we'll want to hear from you. Have you quit your job recently? Are you thinking about leaving? Are you looking to make a change but don't know where to start? You can get ready to call in today around 1:10 Eastern Time. And then later, we'll look at another case of underreported history, this time in Canada, involving the Indigenous community and residential schools, and the report of a mass grave found containing the remains of 215 children on the grounds of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School. We'll speak with journalist and podcast host Connie Walker, who has dedicated her career to covering untold stories of the Indigenous community. That is all on the way, so let's get this started. Years ago, in 1981, a CDC report documented what we now know to be the first known cases of AIDS in the United States. The epidemic peaked 15 years later in 1995. By that year, more than 500,000 American patients had been diagnosed with AIDS and more than 300,000 had died. It was a very scary time as gay men, though not only gay men, but particularly gay men, saw their communities decimated. This was against a backdrop of President Reagan's press secretary, Larry Speaks, joking about the disease when asked about it in a press conference. Pharmaceutical companies were sluggish to develop drugs for what was initially referred to as gay cancer. Lies about how AIDS was spread, plus, you know, homophobia, led to housing and workplace discrimination. Faced with that fear, a drive to survive, and frankly, anger, activists banded together. At the beginning, these activists and the life and death immediacy of the epidemic were met with some indifference. But a group called ACT UP New York, an acronym for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, channeled fury and passion into a force too difficult to ignore. And its legacy has left a mark on public health policy activism that we see playing out today around trans medical care, disability rights, and Medicare for all. Through a new exhaustive history of ACT UP, we get a look at the inner workings of one of the most effective movements of the 20th century. The book is called Let the Record Show, a political history of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. The LGBTQ site Into calls the book, quote, required queer reading that is densely populated with revelations and resonance. The art newspaper calls it a masterclass in activism. Joining me now is its author, former ACT UP member, and co-director of the ACT UP Oral History Project, Sarah Shillman. Sarah, thank you for making time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the words political history are in the book's title. How does a political history differ from a history history?
Well, there's no such thing as a history history. There's so many different lenses, mm-hmm. and there's other kinds of lookbacks on ACT UP. For example, Abram Finkelstein, who was part of the group that designed the logo Silence Equals Death, did a book about graphics. So did Adam Ralston and Douglas Crimp. Peter Staley has a memoir coming out in the fall. So there's a lot of different ways of analyzing the movement. What I'm focused on is not nostalgia per se, but rather cohering the strategies and tactics that made ACT UP successful to try to see if today's activists can get anything out of that knowledge.
Why did you want to give ACT UP this sort of this treatment, this idea of hearing it from people who were there through the oral histories?
Well, you know, ACT UP's achievements were phenomenal. In the 6 years that I cover in my book, 1987 to 1993, they achieved some phenomenal victories. They forced the Food and Drug Administration to make drugs available to people who needed them, even if they had not gone through the approval process. They forced the Center for Disease Control to change the definition of AIDS so that women would qualify for benefits and experimental drug trials. They made needle exchange legal in New York. They took on the Catholic Church, who were trying to stop condom distribution in the public schools, and they were defeated. They made it possible for people with HIV to get private insurance. They started Housing Works, for an organization for homeless people with AIDS. And they changed the way that people with AIDS and queer people felt about themselves and were represented in the mass media. So because of these enormous accomplishments, I thought it would be really helpful for today's movements, which are young people and people of all generations in America desperately want change and want structural change and need this information.
Your book is organized thematically, not chronologically, and there's a timeline at the end to help your readers see how these themes developed over time, but we obviously can't do that on the radio, and the book is 700 pages. But you do provide a section that says how to read this book. How do you want people to read this book and to use this book?
Well, the reason it's not chronological is because if I did it that way, it wouldn't be accurate. Because so many things were going on in ACT UP at the same time. And that was one of its strengths. It had a radical democracy structure, kind of a big tent politics. It had a one-line principle of unity, direct action to end the AIDS crisis. And that was direct action as opposed to social service provision. And within that framework, if you were doing direct action to end the AIDS crisis, basically if you had an idea, you could do it. Because it was not a consensus-based movement. Not everyone had to agree. So if, for example, you wanted to do illegal needle exchange on the Lower East Side to challenge the law, get arrested and have a test case and win, and if I didn't want to do that, I might argue with you, but I wouldn't try to stop you from doing it. I would just find my like-minded people, and we would organize what we wanted to do. And this is the healthiest way to have a movement, because people can only be where they're at. Mm-hmm. So if given a bottom line of agreement, you can facilitate people being effective from wherever they stand, you can end up with a simultaneity of response, and that's how you get a paradigm shift.
And wasn't it also the case that people weren't always transparent with what they were doing because they feared infiltration, and ACT UP had been infiltrated?
Yes, actually at the end of my book I have the Freedom of Information Act FBI files, and you can see that ACT UP was heavily infiltrated and there was a lot of informants. It's heavily redacted, so I can't tell who they were, but it was significant. And people felt that that was true. So there was the official structure, which was a Monday night meeting held at the Lesbian and Gay Center on West 13th Street, and there would be like 300 to 700 people at the meeting. And there would be official committees like fundraising, actions, media, and a coordinating committee and elected facilitators. But there also was an alternate structure where there were affinity groups of 15 to 20 like-minded people who would get together for one action or for years, who would meet at somebody's house, and they would plan often illegal but nonviolent theatrical acts of civil disobedience to avoid being detected by undercover. Now, ACT UP, they did not have to go to the floor to get approval, but ACT UP did provide legal support for those groups. And so it functioned on two levels. Also, as people got sick and died, sometimes affinity groups also became care groups.
My guest is Sarah Shulman. The name of the book is Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. Listeners, will you, an active member of ACT UP, call in and tell us about it? We'd like to hear your stories. The number is 646-435-7280. What actions did you take part in? If you were an active member, we'd love to know how you came to be involved and what it was like at the time. 646-435-7280. I want to back up a little bit, Sarah, because you do provide quite a bit of context for what was going on at the time, and you write about that the narrative that was put forth about AIDS activism came in the early 1990s, often in the forms of fiction, like the film Philadelphia or the play Angel in America, that centered on straight, white, cis men as leaders of the movement. First of all, how did that narrative gain a foothold in the public's awareness?
That's not actually not what my analysis is. I think that when a group is profoundly oppressed and certain representations are heavily rewarded and very, very welcomed by the dominant group, it's important to understand what they're actually saying. You know, we have emotional responses to the fact that they exist at all because there was so little mainstream coverage. But what a lot of, let's take a look at the movie Philadelphia by Jonathan Demme, for example. And this movie won an Oscar, right? It was about a lawyer with AIDS who is being fired arbitrarily because he's ill and he needs an attorney to represent him. So he goes to a homophobic straight attorney played by Denzel Washington. And then you get to watch the homophobic straight guy heroically overcome his prejudices to help the poor abandoned gay man. Actually, in real life, he would have gone to a gay lawyer. Hmm. But the conceit is that there is no gay community. But actually, the abandonment was by the straight world, and it was the gay community that, and the AIDS community that joined together and forced the country to change. So it ends up with a message of heroism or a message that makes straight people feel comfortable, but it's not accurate.
How did you yourself come to join ACT UP?
Well, I was a reporter, so, you know, the media did not cover queer people accurately, and there was a kind of underground alternative gay and lesbian press. And I wrote for those newspapers, Gay Community News, the New York Native, Woman News, and it was kind of like, you know, girl reporter on the go. We didn't really get paid, but we were very committed to finding out what were the stories and what were the realities of our community. And at that time in New York, the big issue was that there was no gay rights bill. So gay people could be fired, they could be denied apartments, they could be denied public accommodation like restaurants and hotels. So I was in City Hall. Ed Koch, who was a closeted mayor, was in office at the time. And this is when AIDS was first recognized by science, 1981. Now, we now know that AIDS existed maybe for 100 years before science noticed the pattern. But it was in 1981 that the New York Times story, 41 cases of rare cancer found in homosexuals in San Francisco, was first published. And at that time, you know, gay people had no rights. Sodomy laws prevailed. Familial homophobia was virulent and the status quo. And gay bashing or street violence against gay people was very common. And there were concepts now they seem very crazy, but ideas that homosexuality was one thing, that perhaps it was biological, it was rooted in your hypothalamus, you know, very stigmatizing and pathologizing concepts. But when a disease was identified among gay people, it got conflated in the public mind with this idea that homosexuality itself was a biological disease. And so you see phrases like gay cancer. Now we know cancer cannot be gay, right? But the first name of this disease was gay-related immune deficiency, which reveals the stigma. In the first 5 years of the AIDS crisis, 40,000 people died in this country. Now we say we're up to about 600,000. But the government did nothing. Pharmaceutical companies did nothing. And the gay community was struggling to create some kind of social service system where gay men's health crisis had a buddy system where volunteers could help you do your grocery shopping or just have someone to talk to. There were groups that delivered food, groups that walked your dog, but there was not a political response. Then, right before ACT UP was founded in March 1987, it was the Bowers v. Hardwick decision in the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court upheld the sodomy law. And this was a blow. The community had been going through a mass death experience, and now gay sex was being reinforced as illegal. And there were very angry demonstrations without permits in the streets, and this was right before ACT UP was founded.
Sarah, what did your participation look like throughout the years?
So I was a reporter for the first 5 years. I covered AIDS through a social justice lens, mm-hmm. and I also covered things like when the health department shut down the bathhouses. I covered mm-hmm. the first arrest of a person with AIDS for civil disobedience, pediatric AIDS, which was very big in New York at the time, women being excluded from experimental drug trials. By the time I joined ACT UP in July of 1987, I'd already been writing about AIDS for about 5 years. Then I was a rank-and-file member of ACT UP from 87 to about 92. I was never in leadership, but I went to all the key actions. I was arrested twice, and like hundreds of people, I went to the Monday night meetings. Then, you know, ACT UP had a very divisive split in 1992, where 12 people formed Treatment Action Group. Hundreds of people stayed in ACT UP, but the group was really devastated by this split. And also, it was a terrible time in the history of AIDS. Many people in ACT UP died. Many beloved leaders died. The new medications were not coming in, and it was a desperate time. In 96 is when you get the protease inhibitors, the drugs that, where if you become infected with HIV, you can live a normal lifespan. And 1999 was the internet revolution, and this really left ACT UP in the dust because we had been a pre-internet movement, and our materials were not digitized. So there was a period where you could search ACT UP and not find anything. And in 2001, I was driving. It was the 20th anniversary of science recognizing the pattern that came to be known as AIDS. And I was listening to the radio, and the reporter said, at first, America had trouble with people with AIDS, but then they came around. And I almost crashed the car. You know, I thought, oh, no, this is going to be one of these stories of the benevolent, dominant culture that just naturally progresses, when the truth is that thousands of people fought until the day they died to force the country to change against its will. So my collaborator and I, Jim Hubbard, started the ACT UP Oral History Project, which people can find at actuporalhistory.org. And over the next 18 years, we interviewed 188 surviving members of ACT UP, and we posted the entire transcripts of their interviews for free, open access. And 14 million people have gone to that site. Then in 2012, Jim made a film called United in Anger, A History of ACT UP, which is available for free on YouTube and Canopy. And we literally carried that film around the world. We went to Russia right after the anti-gay laws, Brazil, India, Palestine, Lebanon, and we met people with AIDS all over the world. But a history started to be told that focused on the concept of a few individuals, people who actually did amazing work in ACT UP and were very heroic, but they weren't the only ones. And the story decontextualized them and singled them out. And it's kind of that American John Wayne myth, you know, that there's a white male individual who comes along and he's heroic and he fixes everything. And that's never been true, and it's certainly not true now, because change in this country really is made through coalition, community, and collectivity. So we realized it was kind of a state of emergency, and we had to be the ones to process all the interviews. And so I took 3 years to reread the interviews I had conducted, and I came up with this book. And so I cover about 140 people.
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention this before the internet age. How did people find their way to the organization?
Oh, it was by human interaction. ACT UP had demonstrations on the streets. Mm-hmm. We put posters up everywhere that if you went out, you would see them. We had something called a phone tree, where each person had like 20 phone numbers, and they would get a message, and then they would call those numbers and send out the message, and then those people would call the numbers on their phone tree. And there was just a lot of, you know, talking to each other. Don't forget, it was inside an already existing community, the queer community. So there was a lot of identification. And it met at the Gay and Lesbian Center, where many people went for lots of other reasons. So that when they would stumble into the center, they would see ACT UP.
My guest is Sarah Shulman. We're talking about her book, Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. We have a couple of callers we'll get to after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. My guest is Sarah Shulman. The name of her book is Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. Sarah, let's take some calls from some listeners. Terry is calling in from Lower Manhattan on line one. Terry, thank you so much for calling All of It. You're on the air. Hey, Terry, are you there? I think Terry is listening to the radio. Let's put Terry on hold, and let's go to Robert on line two, calling in from Manhattan. Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling All of It. Oh, Robert disappeared. Is Terry there? Why don't we let, you know what, I'm going to let the engineer take care of the callers, and then I will come back. Hey, Sarah, I wanted to ask you make a point in the book that I thought was really, I mean, I'm old enough to remember this. I was living in New York at the time, and I was working at MTV, and so obviously living downtown, and it was a very, very scary time. And you make the point, and I want to, this is a quote from your book, that there was a sudden shocking reality check that the powers that be in government, industry, and family didn't care what happened to gay male lives. How did that reality check factor into ACT UP?
Well, ACT-UP was very diverse. Even though it was a predominantly white gay male organization, it crossed a lot of class lines. And there were people in ACT-UP who already knew that the government didn't care about them because they were working class, or because they were people of color, because they were women, or because they were gay men. And then there were people from, there was a small group of people from a real elite. And they were used to being able to negotiate the power apparatus. And when they got AIDS, they found out that there was no support for them at all and no representation. And a number of people in the book, people from like Rick Loftus, a doctor, Sharon Tramatola, who was a housing activist, Ann Northrup, who was a media activist, they all report, you know, hearing some elite gay men just be shocked that the government was not supporting them, while other people in the organization knew that that was the status quo. But there was a wide diversity of experience.
To that point of the wide diversity, in the process of collecting these stories and these oral histories, was there anything that you found where there were discrepancies, that people really remembered incidents or times very differently?
Always. I mean, first of all, ACT-UP people were very strong personalities. They were the kind of people who could not just be bystanders. You know, they were characterologically quite strong. And when we interviewed people, they had a lot of different takes on things. And, you know, my responsibility as the oral historian here was just to let people speak. So a lot of people say things that I don't agree with, or, you know, sometimes in some cases I don't even think it's true. But that was not my job. My job was to show how the people who created the movement felt and what they wanted to express about their own experience.
Let's get to Terry. I think we've got Terry's line sorted out.
Hi.
Hi, Terry.
Listen, I was in ACT-UP from probably almost the time that you were leaving until 1995. And I went to almost every Monday night meeting from the fall of 91 when they had moved to Cooper Union because it was an accessible space until they made the gay center accessible and the meetings started happening on the west side. The way I found out about ACT-UP, I had a whole circle of friends in the Lower East Side, East Village, who were gay men who were getting ill. But Alden McCain had been a friend of mine from the past. He had been one of the founders of SDS, and he was one of the founders of ACT-UP. And he was on Nightline during the San Francisco International AIDS Conference, and I almost immediately connected. I went to three international conferences, presented papers, and coordinated what became the Holistic Treatment Committee. Mm-hmm. Which was not, well, half of my job turned out to be to divert scam artists from preying upon people with HIV who felt very desperate and became vulnerable to these things about being promised that if they paid a fortune, they could go to Italy and have their blood cleaned and put back in them, and just the oddest bunch of stuff, to go to some hut in Ecuador and a shaman would cure them. So, you know, that was half my job. The other half was trying to get people to understand that what their immune system was and how they might give support to it when AZT was all that was available. And it was the hardest road to hoe because the people who created the Treatment Action Group were opposed to any kind of personal support like that for grassroots people who didn't have money and who were just being, I would get people on the phone who had been shuttled from one service agency to the next, just being given another phone number and no help. And I would spend hours on the phone with them every day, helping them to figure out how they could eat healthier, changed their life in ways that, and I knew people who, without any drugs, lived for 20, 30 years by creating regimens for themselves where they would, every bit of water that went into their body was sterile, and they just avoided opportunistic infections. Not many people could live that way. But
well, a lot of it had to do with what strain you had also and what your you know, your pre-existing genetics were, and there were other factors as well.
Terry, thank you for calling in. Let's get to another call. Kevin in Park Ridge. Actually, has a question for you, Sarah. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling All of It.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Allison. Sarah, I've heard you numerous times, and I love what you're doing. And, you know, the message really, really needs to be brought out to people. And, you know, unfortunately, I had a lot of friends and family members. But the thing that you just said that blew my mind completely, and hopefully will blow a lot of other people's minds, if you could explain it a little more fully, that this syndrome, this infection, this disease is over 100 years old?
Well, nobody knows for sure, but there are theories that it crossed from monkeys to humans when, during the colonization of the Belgian Congo, Congolese people were uprooted and pushed further into the woods and had to eat monkey meat that they wouldn't have eaten otherwise. And this contact is how it transferred from animals to humans. That's a theory. I can't prove that. But that would be the turn of the 20th century. Dr. Gremick, who published a book in 1990 that was published by Princeton University Press, showed cases in the 40s of U.S. sailors who had died of a mysterious lung ailment, and that the preserved cells were shown to be pneumocystis pneumonia, and they also had, quote, anal trauma. So it's possible that they had something that was AIDS-related. My interview with Betty Williams, who is a straight Quaker who had worked with homeless people, she reported that people that she worked with had vocabulary words for AIDS symptoms. So, for example, they would call it junkie, they would say there's junkie pneumonia, which we now understand was pneumocystis pneumonia. Or they would call it the dwindles, which we now understand was wasting syndrome. Mm. So that it was pervasive enough in the underclass that people had names for these symptoms. But science didn't notice it until people who had good health care started to have AIDS in a way that their doctors could observe patterns.
Sarah, you know, you turned in your manuscript, obviously, before the pandemic, and Dr. Anthony Fauci is a name that was involved during the AIDS epidemic. And I'm curious, one, what's it been like to watch the narratives around Anthony Fauci and the AIDS epidemic? And what would you like people to know or to think about, or even, you know, just to correct the record?
Well, I mean, of course, I support Dr. Fauci in his opposition, you know, in his role in the coronavirus. But, you know, one of the lessons of this is that people, good people make mistakes and do bad things, and that people are complicated and there's all kinds of contradictions. And when you try to smooth that out and turn people into heroes, pure, clean heroes, you get a story that isn't really true. And, you know, when I look at my manuscript, which I was not thinking about Fauci when I wrote it because his second coming had not occurred yet, but there's a number of incidents where cutting-edge activists came to him with innovations that he rejected. For example, Richard Elovich, who was an advocate for IV drug use reform, he came to Fauci and said, "How come you're not enrolling IV drug users in experimental trials?" And Fauci said that, you know, they're not reliable. And Richard Elovich was that you cannot write off an entire class of people. Linda Meredith, who was an advocate for HIV-positive women, well, it took that campaign 2 years to get a meeting with Fauci. He was really indifferent to the demands of the campaign at the beginning. Jim Igo, who's one of the designers of Parallel Track, he sent Fauci a letter proposing a way to make drugs available to people who needed them before approval, and he was ignored. And 3 months later, he had to go to a public meeting where Fauci was speaking and confront him. You know, and ACTA put a lot of pressure on Fauci and on the NIH and did huge demonstration there and, you know, and used direct action tactics. And eventually Fauci was forced to give people a place at the table. And I'm glad that he did it. And there's two pictures in my, two photos in my book. Mm-hmm. One is an ACTA demonstration where someone's holding a sign saying, "Fauci, you're killing us." And then one is a little bit later when Fauci is actually meeting with members of ACT UP at the Gay and Lesbian Center.
We're going to take one last call before we wrap. because it's someone who I think you may have spoken to. Hi, Donald. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hey, this is Donald. Sarah, you interviewed me for that oral history project. It's Donald Grover.
Oh, great.
And
hi,
I
Donald.
Want to thank you. You know, when your book came out, I went and looked at that oral history project interview again. Because since, you know, the work I was involved in was needle exchange and harm reduction. And mm-hmm. I've never stopped being involved in it. And because you did that interview, it brought back a lot of stuff that I would not have remembered. Mm. That your role as a historian is like, I can't like, you know, say enough about like how important it is, because like even the people doing the work aren't necessarily, I'm placing most of my focus on the stuff I'm working on now. And so I forget, wow, you know, this is really how things were in 1995 or 1997 or all these different periods. It's also beautiful just to hear Alden McKean mentioned, Richard Elovich mentioned, mm-hmm. Linda Meredith mentioned. All of these people were, you know, titans, you know, and they have not been remembered by the legacy that...
But Donald, you were not just a harm reduction activist. You were a church lady for choice.
I still am. And if you come to the Dyke March, we'll be serenading you.
Thank you.
Donald, I'm so glad you called in. Thank you. My guest has been Sarah Shulman. The name of the book is Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. Sarah, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.